Glad to see you guys this morning. Glad you're here. My name is Brent, and I'm the lead pastor here at Ashworth Road. And we just last week, because it was Easter Sunday, we kicked off this brand new series, and you see the title on the screen, Unexpected, What You Never Saw Coming. And so what we're going to do, starting last week and extending for 4 weeks, what we're going to do is be taking a look at this very topic. We're going to see that this period of time from Easter Sunday morning on, just those next 40 days, were completely unexpected. It wasn't anything that people were looking for, but it was during this period that people were just amazed at what took place, amazed at what Jesus was doing and what Jesus was saying. And last week we began by looking at the resurrection of Jesus. We went with the women who were the first ones there. We read Luke's gospel where he talked about the women went there and they showed up and the tomb was empty. And as we saw that, they were taken completely by surprise at this event. Jesus, who had been dead, was supposed to stay dead. That's what the people anticipated. That's what his followers thought was going to happen. And so when the women went to the tomb, they fully expected that to be there. But then when they get there and when they show up, there was a stone that was in front of the tomb. It was moved. They looked inside. They see the clothes that he was wrapped in, those death clothes, still there. But amazingly, the body of Jesus was gone. It was missing. And they really didn't know what to think about this until somebody came. The angel showed up and said, "Let me tell you what this is all about." And the women were the first to believe, and they went back to the other disciples to tell them what had happened. And they were not quite as believing, and that's what we're going to talk about here in just a little bit this morning. But Jesus did rise from the dead. The tomb is empty. And with the resurrection of Jesus, we find this idea that this moment when Jesus comes back to life, there's an unexpected message that is proclaimed in that moment. And that unexpected message is this: simply this, that the life that Jesus has is a life that is offered to you and me as well. He was physically dead. He was raised from the dead. You and I, because of sin, were spiritually dead. But because of the resurrection of power of Jesus Christ, we don't have to stay dead. We can be risen as well. We can come to life spiritually and live eternally with God. And so that's what we looked at. And you know, last week is a big day. I told you last week that it's kind of like the Super Bowl for Christians, right? It's a big day. We celebrate, we rejoice because, woohoo, this is the day that we mark and commemorate this resurrection moment. And it should be an exciting day. And we sang happy songs, and Christians all around the world did this. And it was truly a great day. But you know, for us here, and I'm sure for many around the world, there was a little something here in Iowa that was kind of overshadowing our Easter, wasn't there? There was a little something that had gone on that weekend that was probably maybe still on your mind or something you had considered or thinking about. Because if you were like me on Saturday morning when I woke up, I flipped on the news and what I saw was this horrible tragedy that had taken place on Interstate 80 right near where I live in Waukee. Two policemen were transporting someone across the state late at night. A young man was on the interstate driving the wrong way. And he drove headfirst into that car, killing the two policemen, killing their passenger, and killing himself as well. We heard about these tragic events that took place. So much death, so much carnage. What I didn't know is that when I was up here speaking Sunday morning, that there'd been another event that happened in Waukee. After church last Sunday, I was told by my son, he said, "Dad, did you hear what happened in Waukee?" And I said, "No, what happened?" And he said, "Another kid in our school killed himself. A sophomore at Waukee High School took his own life last Saturday night, Sunday morning." And so while we're here celebrating resurrection, as we're here happy and rejoicing because God has done, in our neighborhood, right down the street from where we are, we have these incredibly tragic events. In fact, the young man that killed himself, my son, Luke, he's a sophomore at Waukee. He knew the guy. Megan is also a sophomore at Waukee. And several kids in our youth group here at Ashworth Road were touched and affected. And what you may not know is that here in our church, we have somebody that it's his job to be on these scenes when these things take place. Clint Robinson, as fire chief of Waukee, his job is to walk into these situations. And somehow make sense or deal with tragedy, to make sense of this horrible mess that we call life. And I don't know about you, and I realize that these are very depressing things for us to think about. And you come on Easter Sunday and you say, Brent, you're all upbeat and happy. And then you come today and you do nothing but tell us sad stories. But isn't that what life is made up for a lot of us by? It's happy moments that are preceded by these moments in life that we don't understand. Moments in life that we're supposed to try to make sense of. Because I don't know about you, but when I hear stories about like what happened on the interstate or this young man that ended his life last week, I pause. I pause, and it makes me have to think for a second. And I scratch my head and I go, why? God, why? What sense is this? What purpose is this? And God, how could you allow this to happen? I mean, really, what purpose is there in any of this? And what can happen to us is when we face these moments in life, and these are things that are outside of me personally. I didn't have to deal with either of these situations, and it wasn't my family. But then sometimes it happens to us personally. Just this week, I was talking to someone, and they were sharing with me about a family member who was having back pain, and they were going to go in and have surgery. And in that surgery, they come out and they say they can't even finish the surgery because the body is eaten up with cancer, stage 4. This is a woman in her early 40s. I'm in my early 40s. When things like this hit close to home, they absolutely cause us to stop dead in our tracks. And we just begin to wonder what is going on and how could God do this? And oftentimes, when we begin to face these kind of questions, it can lead to doubts. It can lead to doubt, to doubting about God, doubting about whether or not He's a good God, doubting whether or not He's a God that we can trust, doubting whether or not the questions of the future and heaven or death and eternity and questions about the reality and the solidity of our faith. How sound is our faith in those moments when we just can't make sense of life? And what are we supposed to do with this? You know, sometimes we see these events, but sometimes we go through these events. And sometimes it's not even events that take place. Sometimes it's just through life. It's through life itself we enter and we encounter dark experiences, what some have called the dark night of the soul, where you just look and you kind of wonder, where is God? I'm praying, I'm trying to be faithful Christian, but where is God in all this? And you look and you can't seem to find Him. And it begins to lead to these doubts where you go, well, maybe this isn't true after all. Maybe I've been building my life on something that's not correct. Or we read an article on the internet where somebody, you know, calls into question a belief that you have. Years ago, you may remember Dan Brown wrote a book. It was a fiction book called The Da Vinci Code. And in that book, he asserted that Jesus didn't really die and that he was married and had a kid. And so a lot of people in the Christian faith, even though it was a fiction book, they walked away from that going, well, I wonder, what if that's true? And every now and then on the news, these stories pop up, don't they? They pop up and they tell you that, oh, Jesus really didn't die, or Jesus is still dead, and we found His body, and Jesus did this, or whatever. And anytime we hear those, if you're like me, sometimes you go, oh, could that be true? Is it possible? Or we hear somebody like a celebrity. Bill Maher hates Christians. He just hates Christians completely, and he'll say things like this: religion is for those who don't think. And sometimes we think we have to leave our brains at the door when it comes to faith. Or there's a German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who said this. He said, I've had therefore to remove knowledge in order to make room for doubt. Wasn't that what you want to hear? Leave your brain at the door. Isn't that the sign that we have up above? The door's there back there. Leave your brain at the door, all you who enter, so that you can just believe. You know, we have doubts. But what do we do with these doubts? You know, I think some of you may be sitting there today, and you're sitting maybe outside of this faith realm. You see it, you've heard about it, maybe your family's talked to you about it, but you're kind of sitting on the outside looking in. And you yourself have a lot of doubts about how this could possibly be true. You've heard the claims, but you're here in your doubt or something. providentially has led you here today to take a closer look. Some of you are on the inside of faith and you're a Christ follower and you're one who's trying to live like Jesus lived, but for whatever reason, you're having some doubts. You're beginning to question. You want, and you think about it, and you go to your, you think to yourself automatically, you think, stop it. Stop it. Don't do that. Good Christians don't ever have doubts. Good Christians don't ever raise these kind of questions. So if I'm going to be a good Christian, I just have to put it out of my mind. And at least that's what we tell ourselves. And we want to talk about it with someone, but we're afraid that those doubts we're having, they're not acceptable. And after all, we begin to think, well, if I have doubts, isn't that the opposite of faith? And doesn't that just prove that I'm far away from God or that I don't even know Him at all? I'm going to ask that question here in just a second. What I want to help you see here today is that doubt is normal. It happens. It's not intrinsically right or wrong. But unexpected doubt will do one of two things to your faith. Unexpected doubt can either sever you from faith or it can really deepen and strengthen your faith. But what might shock us is when we understand that it's when we go through these seasons of unexpected doubt that it can really produce within us an incredibly unexpected faith. Now, when it comes to the Christian faith, when we start talking about the word doubt, I imagine there's somebody, if you've been in church any at all, or you've been through Sunday school as a kid especially, when I say Christian and doubt, there's probably an individual from about 2,000 years ago that jumps into your mind, you know, one of Jesus' disciples that is really associated with. In fact, help me out here. Who are we talking about? Doubting who? Thomas, there you go. See, you already knew. And doubting Thomas. And we find the story of doubting Thomas in John chapter 20. And so we're going to be looking there, John chapter 20, and I want us to read his story, and I want us to figure out, okay, what can we take from his experience of doubt and learn from it? What can we take and apply to our own lives and grow from this? And so John chapter 20, we're going to start in verse 24, says this. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." Now let me set this up for you just a second. This right here in John 20 is 1 week. It's today. It's 1 week after Easter. And so Thomas is with the disciples, and they're saying, "Hey, we've seen him." So let's go back a week prior, okay, Easter Sunday. The women have gone to the tomb. Jesus is not there. It's empty. But Jesus is beginning to reveal himself to people. He shows up to Mary. Mary doesn't even recognize him at first. Mary Magdalene, she's like, "Oh, are you the gardener?" And he's like, "No, Mary, it's me." And she's like, "Oh, Jesus." And then later that same Easter Sunday, that very first Sunday, Jesus appears to 10 of the disciples. Now, there were 12, remember, but Judas has killed himself at this point. And Thomas, for some reason, is not there. We're not told where he is. We don't have a clue if he's down at the local pub drowning his sorrows. We don't know if he's hiding because he's scared of his own life. We don't know where he is. The Bible never tells us where he is. But we know he's not there. And so on this first Easter Sunday, these disciples, these 10 and the women and the others that have been following Jesus, they have this experience where Jesus comes to them. And in fact, let's take a look at that and read that portion of the story. We have to jump back to Luke's gospel to pick this up. And so Jesus here in Luke 24, 36, it's going to be on the screen. It says, while they were talking about this, this is a story you're going to hear next week, so make sure you're here for that. But as they're talking about this other event, Jesus stood himself stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." They were startled and frightened, thinking they saw a ghost. Now, amazing, right? They've heard the story of the women. They know the tomb is empty. Peter's already seen the tomb being empty. And Jesus appears in this room, and their first reaction is what? Ghost. Crazy, right? All right, he says to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts rise in your minds?" And again, remember, this is talking to the 10, not to Thomas. He's telling them, "Why are you doubting?" Jesus says, "Look at my hands and my feet. It is I, myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." When he said this, he showed them his hands and feet. And while they still did not believe it because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything here to eat?" Clarification there in verse 41, it says, while they still did not believe it. It's almost like it's too good to be true. It's not that they necessarily didn't believe it, but they thought, this is way too good to be true. And then he says, give me something to eat. Very amazing thing Jesus does there, because they're thinking he's a ghost. Ghosts don't eat, at least not in the Casper cartoons that I've ever seen, that he had an apple or anything. But ghosts don't eat. And so Jesus is saying, okay, I understand you're still thinking this is a little bit too good to be true. So hey, give me something to eat. I'll prove to you that I'm flesh and bone. I'll prove to you that I'm alive. And so we continue on. It says, they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and he ate it in their presence. And he said to them, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. Then he opened their minds so they could understand the scripture. He told them, this is written, the Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning in Jerusalem. Man, that's an amazing passage right there that we could sit on for a while. We're not going to, but underline that in your Bibles or something. Go back and reread that. Listen to what Jesus said. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance for the forgiveness of sin will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning in Jerusalem. And then he finishes by saying, you are my witnesses of these things. I'm going to send you what my Father has promised, but stay in this city until you have been clothed with power from on high. So here we see this first appearance by Jesus to his disciples. We see this first appearance, and I don't know about you, but if I'm Thomas, I'm feeling at this moment, right now, today, looking back 2,000 years later, I'm feeling like I got a bad rap. I'm feeling like, you know, things aren't going my way, because when we read that first part of John 20 there, it never said, and Thomas doubted. It just talks about he wasn't there, and he says, I want proof for myself. And yet doubting is used to describe the other guys. I mean, how does Thomas, for 2,000 years, get remembered as the guy who doubts? They were all in the same boat. They were all in the same position going, we're not believing it until we see it and touch it and feel it and know it's real. And in this moment in Luke, Jesus appears to his 10. And like I said, Thomas is absent. And Jesus shows those 10 who he is. He makes himself known to be real. And from that moment, their doubt is removed. Those 10 have an encounter with Jesus that all doubt is gone. They believe. They're convinced. They know it's real. And so fast forward and think about these next 7 days. How annoying these 10 disciples probably were to Thomas. I mean, can you hear it in your mind, right? Thomas, you should have been there. Yeah, I know, but I wasn't. Move on. Right? I mean, and he's, oh no, but he's real. Yeah, whatever. I'm not buying it. 7 days of Thomas just getting this over and over in his face. And then for a week, Thomas must live in this place of question. He has to live in this place of doubt. Because he hears what his friends say. And remember, these are guys that he's hung out with for 3 years. These aren't just people that have come up to him, strangers off the street. And yet they're telling him, Thomas, it's real. It happened. But then he's got to make sense of it. So what did they see then? Because I don't know that it's true. So was it a ghost? Was it a hallucination? Have they been drinking a little too much of the communion wine, you know? I mean, what's going on here? And then finally, a week later, Jesus appears to Thomas to kind of settle the story, to settle his doubt, to prove to him, like he'd done to the others, exactly what had gone on, exactly who he was. And so if you look back again in John chapter 20, we wrap up the story. Starting in verse 26, it says, a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. And though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them. And he said, peace be with you. Now let's think about this for a moment. They're thinking he's a ghost. The house is locked up tight and Jesus somehow gets in. So that's not really helping that he's a ghost. I'm not a ghost scenario, right? I mean, so there's still some questions here. So before we jump on Thomas and be like, he's right in front of you, Thomas. Well, the man just walked through a wall. Let's give Thomas a break here. So then Jesus says to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hands and put your hand into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Oh, so Jesus looks at Thomas and says, oh, you are doubting. Thomas says to him, looking at Jesus, he says, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Somehow Jesus shows up in this room. He greets them and he goes right to Thomas. And he says to Thomas, I know what you've said. I know that you said unless you can touch it, unless you can feel it, you're not going to believe. So Thomas, go ahead. I'm right here standing in front of you. Touch, feel. And he looks at him and he says to him, Thomas, you've got to stop doubting and believe, which would better be interpreted, do not become unbelieving. It's not that he was unbelieving, but he was right on the fence. But even Jesus, as he appears, what's amazing to me is that that's all Thomas needed. We never have recorded that Thomas ever touches Jesus. Because for Thomas, seeing is believing. That's all he needs. That's all that it took. And he responds to Jesus with one of the greatest confessions that we have in the Bible. Up there with all the other great confessions like Peter, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Thomas, when he recognizes and realizes it's really Jesus, he says to him, you are my Lord and you are my God. And this is kind of an important moment in history because especially right here in John's Gospel, this is the first time we see this expression used of Jesus. I mean, we think about this for a moment, my Lord, that's a new one, but then he says, and my God. And when we think about who these guys are, these were good Jewish boys who were raised in good Jewish faith. What was one, the main primary tenet that they grew up believing? The Lord your God is one. There is one God. And so we need to understand that in this moment, this is an incredible moment of faith for Thomas to say, you are my God. A monotheistic guy who would never have said anything else is God looks at Jesus and says, you are. Are God. This is an amazing moment. But that amazing moment was first preceded by this guy who was doubting. And we get some great insights into him and what I think God thinks about us when we doubt. You see, we have to understand that the doubt is a reality. It's a part of life. It's a part of existence. For many of us, when we hear about doubting Thomas, you know what we think? We think, oh, he's a terrible guy. We think he's a bad person. And as I was reading this week, one commentator said, you know, he does get a bad rap, but what we need to understand is that even though we call him Doubting Thomas, what we should call him is Honest Thomas. Because at least he was willing to own his stuff. At least he was willing to say, hey, I'm not buying into this until I see it for myself. He was really probably one of the most honest ones there. But when we think about doubt, I think we can fall into one of two camps. We can see doubt as a vice, as a negative, as a sin, or we can see it as the ultimate virtue. You see, our culture looks at doubt and they say there is no greater thing you can do than to doubt everything all the time. They elevate doubt as if it's some great thing that we achieve. And what we find happening, though, is that when we doubt, when we see doubt this way, we find that we think we're intellectually superior to those who have faith. And all we do is we end up living in this ubiquitous place of confusion and question without ever finding an answer. But on the other side, when we think it's a sin, we find ourselves pushing away from it, thinking, I can never have doubts. I can never deal with this. We think of it almost as one of the seven deadly sins, which I'll tell you, it's not. And when people come into the community of faith and they begin to have doubts, what do we do with those people? Did you hear about her? Good grief, Leslie. She was asking some questions. That's what happens when you sit up close, Leslie. She was asking some questions. I don't even think she's a Christian. I'm going to stop hanging out with her. How about you? She's going to pull us all down. Isn't that what we do? And instead of having a community of faith where people can honestly come in and share these questions and share doubt, what we do is we find ourselves shunning. And these people that are genuinely searching for answers don't find a safe place to express this difficulty and belief. And so what happens is they hide and they struggle in isolation and alone. And preachers have been so bad at dealing with doubt for so long because people like me would stand up here and go, are you doubting? Don't doubt. Just believe. Have more faith. And you know what that does for you? Absolutely nothing. That's the dumbest thing somebody could tell you in the moments of doubt. Just believe more. It's not reassuring, and it certainly doesn't produce any confidence or any faith. But I'm hoping that as we've read this story that you see that if even the disciples struggled, maybe doubt is more common among people who follow Jesus than we would like to let on, than we want to admit. That Christian faith is not automatically free from doubt. And just because you doubt doesn't mean you're not a Christian. It doesn't mean that you're not following Christ. It doesn't mean that you're bad. And that can even be okay to have doubts. Because doubt is common. In fact, author Philip Yancey says it's the skeleton in the closet of faith. And we're hoping bringing that skeleton out today. Because the truth is we all struggle with doubt. If you don't struggle with it today, I hope that you've struggled with it at some point. If you haven't, you will at some point. It's just part of life. It's how we live. The struggle is real. And we all deal with it. And can I let you in on a little secret? Even pastors deal with doubt sometimes. We are not immune. And the same questions that you've had about God, about Jesus, about fill in the blank when it comes to faith, I can promise you, Brent Clark has had those same doubts and questions. What's great about the Christian community is that there are no superheroes in this room. No one gets to wear a cape. We're all on the same level. Doubt is real, and it happens to the best of us. What we have to be careful of, though, is marginalizing those who admit it. Did you see how Jesus responded to Thomas? He didn't walk in the room and say, Thomas, I have told you and told you, get your crap together. What is wrong with you, man? Get out. Go away. No. What did Jesus do? How did Jesus respond? He didn't disparage him or belittle him or even say, you have no faith at all. In fact, Jesus amazingly meets Thomas exactly where he is. He meets him at the point of his need, saying, hey, Thomas, you said you needed proof. Here you go. He doesn't say, how could you look at me and not believe? He doesn't say, you don't get to touch me. He goes, no, Thomas, if this is what you need, go ahead. I want to help you strengthen your faith. I want you to know that it's really me. And Jesus says, I will meet you at the point of your doubt. Isn't that amazing? Jesus is willing to meet us at the point of our doubt. I do want to make a point of clarification here that when we talk about doubt, I want us to consider one of two ways we may be coming at this. And as I was reading a book this week, it's Help My Unbelief by Barnabas Piper. He describes it this way, and I thought it was good. He says, when we talk about doubt, we really need to realize there are two different types of doubt in our life. There's believing doubt, and there's unbelieving doubt. You see, doubt on its face value is just simply to be uncertain. It's to think that something may not be true. You're just not certain. But doubt is not the same as unbelief. Get that. Doubt, just because you doubt doesn't mean you don't believe. It just means you're uncertain. And so we have this two types of doubt, believing doubt and unbelieving doubt. And unbelieving doubt can be very dangerous because unbelieving doubt is the kind of doubt that will keep you from moving forward. It's the kind of doubt that says, hey, I'm going to ask some questions, but I'm really not interested in any answers. All I want is just to ask a bunch of questions, but please don't try to answer them. Please don't talk to me about it because I want to live here in my skepticism. I want to be sitting on the sidelines and throwing bombs at people of faith, and really I don't care if they have an answer or not. It doesn't matter. And while I'll deconstruct everything that I believe, I'm not interested in reconstructing anything in its place. It's skepticism with no desire for clarity, certainty, or assurance. But believing doubt is the type that Thomas had. Believing doubt, it asks good and honest questions, actually looking for answers, answers that will strengthen us and propel us forward in faith. An unbelieving doubt where it'll pull us away from God and it'll destroy what little faith we might have, believing faith will pull us deeper, strengthening our faith to greater depths than we've ever seen before in our life. Understanding it, it gives us a solidness of our faith. Planting our feet firmly in the nature and character of God, in the work and the person of Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit. You guys, I quote Tim Keller a lot. He's a pastor in New York. I love him. He wrote a book called The Reason for God. And he wrote this, and I thought it was a great quote. He says, "A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she's failed over the years to listen patiently to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection." Doubt is not bad. Believing doubt, it's not a bad thing. Questioning is not wrong. It indicates that you're wanting an answer, and it matures us in faith. And often when doubts arise, we think, "God, I don't want to be here. I don't want to doubt. I don't want to question. Take me back where I was in faith with you." And it doesn't work that way. Because when we begin to doubt and when we begin to ask questions and we begin to get answers, it moves us to a place further along the faith journey than we could be. And we can never go back to where we were. We don't want to go back to where we were. So what do we do with our doubt? Maybe you're struggling today. Maybe you have a lot of questions. Hopefully this is helpful. Maybe you're sitting out there and you're thinking, "Brent, I'm enduring this message because I don't have doubts." Well, listen up. Help somebody that's struggling with doubt. How do we deal with our doubt? The first thing is this. We begin by acknowledging it. Man, Christians are great at self-denial, aren't we? We're great at, man, ignoring things and, "Oh, no, no, not me. How are you?" "I'm fine. Life is good. You just fought with your wife all the way to church. Your kids are demons and you walk in this building. You have a smile on your face. I'm great. You good?" Yeah. Stop it. Just stop it. Stop the madness, please. Admit it. Knowing that you're not less than anybody else in this room when you take that step forward. And you had acknowledged, "Okay, you know, I'm struggling a bit. This doesn't make sense to me." So we begin with acknowledging doubts will come. There's nothing inherently sinful about that. But I will say, even though there's nothing sinful about it, we are responsible for how we deal with our doubts. So we'll keep moving forward. The second thing is this. Find someone you trust. Find someone you can be open to and talk to about these questions that you're having, the doubts that are raising up. You know, a lot of times when we doubt and we struggle, we think, "Oh, I want to go hang out with other people that doubt and struggle." Don't do that. That is not helpful. What you need to do is find someone with faith, someone who has enough faith that you can lean on. And so that their faith, while you may have none right now, their faith can carry you forward. As one blog I read this week said, find friends who are strong in their faith and you breathe in their faith. That's what you need to do. Find somebody to talk to. And if you are that person that somebody comes to talk to, the next point is for you. Create a safe space. Create a safe space where somebody can come in with honest questions, where someone can come in and be real and be vulnerable without them feeling the judgmental condemnation of Christianity falling down upon them. Give them a safe place to be able to explore. Don't ridicule. Don't criticize. Because you know what? God might just be using you to help strengthen somebody in a way that you couldn't even imagine, to deepen somebody's faith in an amazing way. The next thing is this. Get to the root of your doubt. Are there serious questions you cannot answer about God, the resurrection, or faith? Or is it the doubt that's caused by circumstances in your life? They're different, and they have to be approached in different ways. Often when we're in the middle of our own stuff, we can't see anything outside of our stuff. We just see the circumstances that we're drowning in. Sometimes we need that outside perspective to show us what we might be going through might not be exactly the way we're perceiving it to be. And just because we look at what we're going through as bad and negative and terrible, it doesn't negate who God is or what Jesus has done. Because truth lies not in our circumstances, but in the person and work of Jesus Christ. Sometimes our circumstances really blind us. We need somebody that can say, "Hey, maybe this isn't the tragedy you see. Maybe there is blessing here along the way." The next thing is this. Ryan loves this one. He was giving me grief about it. Doubt your doubts. He gave me grief because he says, you know, we love love. He gives, you know, so he said, doubt your doubts. So it's like, okay, what do I mean by doubt your doubts? Sometimes when we approach Christianity, we go, oh, well, some of this stuff can't be true. And we assume by default that everything on the opposite side, the outside of Christianity, oh, that must be true. Not really. You realize that atheists and agnostics also doubt, also question. I was reading quote after quote this week from atheists who would say things like, I really hope I'm right. But you know what? I have a lot of friends and I have a lot of smart people. I know a lot of smart people that are faith, that are people of faith. They're following Jesus. They have just as many questions too. Doubt your doubts. Consider why the questions you're having might not be completely defensible either. The next one is this. Recognize that the struggle of doubt doesn't reveal that no faith is there. In fact, when we doubt and when we struggle, it's actually a sign that we have faith. Isn't that opposite of how we think? Isn't that opposite of what we're believing? But when we doubt, it means we're actually in faith. And then last one is this. Jesus will meet your doubt with revelation, just like he did with Thomas. If you're doubting, if you're seeking God, if you're dependent, getting help from someone else, be ready because Jesus will meet you with revelation. So what he did with Thomas, he showed up and he said, here I am. He'll do the same for you. And then the last one is this. And when Jesus shows up, accept it. Accept it. The amazing thing about Thomas is he didn't need to see or touch it. He saw and it was enough. Be willing to listen to those around you that help you, that'll help see you through this difficult thing. And listen and receive. Thomas's response to his doubt being overcome was, my God and my Lord. We need to respond. So let me wrap this up. The ultimate thing I want you to take away from this is doubt is not bad, but doubt will either sever your faith or strengthen your faith. It'll sever your faith or strengthen your faith. We all have doubts. We wonder why these things happen. We wonder why the world looks the way it does. We wonder why God would allow terrible things in our lives. Some struggle with doubt that Jesus could really sacrifice himself for us. Why would he do that? But the doubt should be overcome with the truth that he did and he went to the cross for you. What I want to wrap up and just close with this is right here. Thomas gets a really bad rap in Scripture for being doubting. And one of the downfalls of the Bible, yeah, you heard me say that, is that we don't get to see the rest of Thomas's story. And I don't know if you've ever studied it or ever looked at it, but if you study Thomas, you see him, you know, we see him make this great confession. And what scholars tell us happened to Thomas after that is his life was changed forever. He went to the far reaches of the world. He was one of the first missionaries to go to the Far East, to India, to begin sharing the gospel. In fact, if you still go there today, I'm told that there are a lot of churches and things dedicated to him because of his early mission work. That he was so on fire for Jesus that he went and even laid down his life. He died a martyr. Historically, it said he was pierced through the side. Isn't that interesting? Because of his faith. Can I tell you, we often think that if we doubt, that couldn't happen. We often think if you doubt, oh no, there's no hope for you at all. But that's not the case with Thomas. Thomas doubted. Jesus met him at the point of his need. Jesus revealed himself and Thomas responded. And you know what happened? Thomas's faith became so strong. He developed an unexpected faith so deep that he went to the ends of the earth telling people about Jesus and died for the cause of Christ. When you doubt, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You too, through your doubts, can have an unexpected faith come out on the other side, just like Thomas did. What will you do with your doubt this morning? Will you pray with me?